With such enthusiasm, let's welcome Brooklyn and Alex, who are going to present AutoMerge plus KeyHive, the design overview.
All right, thanks for your patience, everyone. Right, so yeah, we're going to talk about AutoMerge and KeyHive and local first infrastructure. I'm Alex.
I'm Brooke. We're going to talk about AutoMerge and KeyHive.
Here's a bunch of our supporters, including NLNet, who I think are in the room. So thank you, everyone. And I'm going to start by talking about the problem that we think local first infrastructure can solve. And I'm going to do that by talking a little bit about a little story I like to tell, which is how about 5 years ago I wrote this application, which is a little tiny little Android app for tracking workouts. I wrote it in about an hour. It's basically a nice front end on a spreadsheet. Because using a spreadsheet in the gym is pretty hard work. And I was really pleased with it. And then a friend of mine a week later said, oh, could I have that? And I would like to use it to sync with my laptop. And I thought about what I would need to do to allow him to be able to sync with his laptop. And it was, well, he'd have to write a server-side component in some language. It's eventually there. I'd have to write some sync code. And then like the most important thing is I would have to actually run a server somewhere, or he would have to run a server somewhere. And I think this particular story, because it's a very small piece of software that I wrote almost as a throwaway. It's not a very important thing that I want to spend a lot of time on. And I think the fact that I would have to host a server somewhere in order to do this represents like a loss or a difficulty.
Can you speak higher, apparently?
You want me to speak louder?
Yeah.
All right. represents a loss of something that I think is really important in open source software, and something the most important thing to me about open source software is the autonomy that it gives me. If I don't like a change that someone makes to a piece of software, I can make a change to it, or someone makes, I can refuse that change. I have a lot more freedom than with closed source software. And as soon as you have a server-side component running, whoever is running that server is now controlling something about your experience, is now able to force choices on you that you don't like. And I think the normal answer that we think of in open source to this problem is say, well, you should self-host. You should run every part of the stack yourself. And I think that works for some things. It works for big, important things. But for these little things, this little app that I wrote for my workout tracker, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to run a server for every little piece of software I want to write. And I think the analogy to infrastructure here is a little bit like electricity. Factories used to build their own power stations. And that's great for factories, and many still do. But like, I don't want to build a power station to use my Hoover. I want to have a piece of infrastructure that I can plug into. And this is the problem here. Self-hosting is work, and it means that most things, most people don't self-host. And so we don't, even if the whole stack of a piece of software is open source, we don't actually get the autonomy that we wanted. So we're in this room. Obviously, local first is the answer. This is what I'm going to say. You expect. And I, like, there's a lot of appealing things about local first. There are no servers needed. That's the idea of the principle that is behind local first, is that the local version of the data is the thing that is primary. But servers are actually really useful. Even if you're in like a local first peer-to-peer world, servers are always on. If you don't have a server that's always on, if you're just peer-to-peer between our laptops, we have to make sure that whoever has the data has their machine on. Also, modern networks are kind of impenetrable for peer-to-peer use cases a lot of the time. And having a well-connected, well-known location where something is always on makes connectivity much easier. And also, it's easier to do backup and redundancy on a server. So servers are really useful, and I don't think we actually get much benefit from saying we shouldn't use them at all. Instead, I think we want a couple of design principles that make it possible to work with servers without sacrificing our autonomy. First off, you should always be able to use some server. It doesn't matter which server. You should be able to stand one up. You should be able to any kind of server you can point out. It should be a pretty fungible, replaceable thing. Secondly, you shouldn't ever be required to use any particular server. Like, if you're using your sync server, fine, I should be able to use mine. We should still be able to collaborate without being forced to use the same ones. And a server should never be able to do anything more dangerous than just not serve data. And so those kind of principles are behind how AutoMerge works. So I'm going to just briefly introduce AutoMerge. This is a very high-level overview of architecture rather than a walkthrough of how to use AutoMerge. So This is a very brief intro, but AutoMerge is a JavaScript library. Well, it's also a couple of other platforms, but this is the JavaScript version. And it's centered around documents. So you create an AutoMerge document. The document appears just like a JavaScript object, except that when you want to make changes to it, you call this function to make changes to it. And you can see here we've got given a callback where we modify some attributes of this document. And then you can merge that document with other versions of the same document. And conflicts are resolved automatically. I'm not claiming that this is magical. It's similar to the way that Jazz works in a lot of ways, LDAP-based, like last-write wins-based conflict resolution. But we hold on to the history. So if you want to go and look at how that conflict was resolved, change it, you can do that. Great. How do we actually do that? So that's the interesting part I want to talk about here with respect to the infrastructure arguments. Is that we already have a local first application where servers are pretty fungible, which allows you to work with local changes. And that's Git. And Git's really, really, really good at this stuff. And one way, it's also really, really bad at this stuff. Everyone hates Git for good reasons. But the core model is powerful. And one way of thinking about AutoMerge is it's like Git for JSON. And what I mean by that is that under the hood, an AutoMerge document is a commit DAG like this, where instead of in Git, where the contents of each commit would be the changed files, well, actually the entire snapshot of the file system, but in AutoMerge, the contents of each commit are changes to a JSON document. JSON-like. There's some extra features over JSON, but that's not too important for now. And this has some nice properties. Most importantly, the server just has to ship commits around. It doesn't have any special logic. It doesn't. You don't actually have to care about the contents of those commits. So you see later that means we can actually encrypt the contents of the commits and the server doesn't need to know anything different. We can examine the history. So we never throw away any of these commits. That means that you can always, I can always say, oh, no, at this point in the commit history I was doing X and I can go back and look at it. I can compare the difference between two points in history so I can diff the document just like I can with Git. And it's hash linked, which has some really useful properties when we're talking about infrastructure, which is one, if you and I both have the same, have derived the same hash for some commit, we know that we're looking at the same thing, right? Like we don't have to trust that anyone in between correctly shipped data around. And we correctly doesn't just mean like that they weren't malicious, it means that they weren't buggy. And that's really useful because a lot of the, we're talking about concurrent changes. A lot of the edge cases are pretty fiddly. Knowing that we both have the exact same data, if we know that and we see something different, we know that we have like a view problem. The implementation is correct, producing the wrong view, but we have the same data. And it also means that we can sign over those commits, which is really useful. I want to talk about one thing here, which is that we don't throw away any data, right? So we're collecting every keystroke you make. And there's been talk in various talks previously already about compacting or throwing away data. For us, this is a deliberate choice not to throw away data. It's really useful because it means you can always look at what was different. And when you're talking about local first software and concurrent changes, being able to see what happened and what changed so that you can disagree and change your mind is really important and liberating. But it also has a lot of overhead. So in order to make this possible, we take this commit log on the right, and we encode it as a columnar compressed format. So we get in the commit format, you get overhead of, you know, one commit hash per keystroke. Yeah, there's quite a lot of overhead there. Actually, a couple of hashes because you have to reference the parent commits as well. But once we've done this columnar compression, we end up with about a kind of a one byte overhead on typical payloads. So you end up, as long as you're being smart about how you're compressing this stuff, you don't worry too much about the history size. And this is like an analogy to Git as well. Git has, no one really worries too much about the fact that Git doesn't throw away all of its history or track everything. Like that's a useful feature of it. And there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood to make that possible. But I think it's a feature and it's, when you're talking, it's a trade-off that's very important to think hard about. And we think that the right side of that trade-off for the kinds of things that we're working on is to hold all of history. And what about conflicts? Well, they're resolved client-side in the sense that we'll choose for some, if there's two conflicting writes, we'll choose one such that everyone chooses the same one who has the same data. But we also give you all the history in a way to resolve them differently if you want. LDAP done by default and history retained. The principle here is servers are dumb pipes. They're not doing anything except shipping around commits. They can't interpret your data and they can't use your edits. They just forward things. In practice, this works pretty well. We have a lot of we use this a lot ourselves, and we have a lot of maybe strange topologies. Like, for example, we have in our web applications, we often have a sync server, which is actually a service worker talking to another sync server, just because it's nice to have a homogeneous architecture, and it's fine. The main place where this becomes a problem in practice is when you want to authenticate and authorize access to your documents. And this becomes a point where most people using AutoMerge end up having to have a central sync server that authenticates the read and writes. And so that's why we've been working on KeyHive, which I'm going to hand over to Brooke to talk about.
Great, thanks. All right, KeyHive, not the actual logo, but we thought we'd modify the AutoMerge logo because I want a logo too. So the question is, what would signal for documents look like in this local first world? We need group end-to-end encryption and post-compromise security. So we have the security level where if somebody breaks in and you don't detect it, we still kick them out automatically. We need mutation control. We need to protect and prevent people that aren't authorized from editing your documents, obviously. And we need peering rules. We don't want people to be able to DOS you or pull down copies of your data, even if it's encrypted. And I'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. But that's actually a very important property. So all of these things actually end up being a really nice fit for local first. We've been pulling, you know, ideas and techniques from different fields. But as Alex just illustrated, this is very helpful if we want to have interchangeable sync servers. So why prevent peering? Well, we need defense in depth. So on every node, because you know the one you have locally is the same as the thing running on the server, we have our data encrypted in a nice little envelope there. And if you leak the key, so by accident you post the key for this file to GitHub or on Blue Sky or wherever, well, we're going to not peer with them because they're not in our, they're not authorized to actually ask for those bytes. If somebody breaks into the server and they don't have the key, you're still okay because the bytes are encrypted unless somebody leaks the key. And so this means that you can still access your own data, but it radically lowers the bar to running one of these servers. You can run it poorly. You can run it, just spin one up temporarily. You can switch between servers, and all of that will just work. And you don't have to worry about these really tricky things like, how do I secure access to my data? It's just built in. But access control in this world happens at write time. We're doing encryption. This sets a ceiling on how secure your document can be. The choices that we make mean that we're going to impose a security model on your application. So this is the trade-off when you think about these things as infrastructure, is any choices that we make are going to affect all of your applications. So just a quick rundown comparison. In a traditional system, so if you think, say, OAuth, the server's the thing fundamentally in control. In this model, you are in control. In a central server, you know exactly who has access to do what right now, but because local first, you can have people being offline. Well, you might have an out-of-date view and reconcile that later. Server can block access to anyone. In KeyHive, the auth travels around with the document no matter where it lives. And you don't need a live connection at all. We can do, over Bluetooth, and this continues to work. So fundamentally, you become the authority. You can switch servers, and they are completely interchangeable infrastructure. One of the components that we use to do this is called a capabilities model. This is a nice primitive for building up other things that people are more familiar with. So the way this fundamentally works is the document itself and all the users in the system have an ID as a public key. And we call this a delegation. And we are going to write in operations that say things like, Bob can edit this document and sends that to sends that between different users. And as we, you know, the document delegates this to Alice and Alice delegates to Bob, we can follow this chain back through and know, without having to check any particular place, we all have a copy of all of these operations, all these certificates. We know exactly who's able to do what on this document. And then we take all of this and we sign over it cryptographically. Everybody has their own keys. They can sign it just like how you sign your Git commits, I hope. That makes it verifiable everywhere. Out of this, you can build lots of different things. So you can build your role-based access control. You can say, you know, Alex is a member of Ink and Switch, and so he's allowed to write to these documents. These documents are in this directory. If you have access to this directory, you have access to all of these other files. And you can also build other systems. People are, you know, some people really like attribute-based access control and these other systems. You can build those all up out of these simpler primitives. There is, because of the no central auth, we have out of order auth. So if you do revocation, this means that we have to think about this on two timelines. We have the original set of delegations and who we were bringing into the document. And if we kick somebody out, we're basically reaching back in time and changing what they're able to, what they have access to. This means that we have to take the edits that they made on the document. So let's say they started defacing the document and writing all kinds of horrible things into it. We can go back in time and remove those edits after the fact. This looks basically the same as the bringing somebody in. It's, again, an operation that we sign over. So there's no system-wide super admin baked in. This is just whoever creates the document gets access to it automatically and by default. Groups can have admins if you want, but they don't have to automatically. These are concepts that are expressible in the system, but not mandatory. And authority always starts with a document creator and flows out from them. So, the grand vision. This is all infrastructure. Local first, CRDTs, all of this, sync servers, etc. They're things that we all benefit from, we all depend on. No one can take them away. And they're going to last beyond us or a single project, so our users don't lose all of their stuff. It's not tied to any particular app, any company, any one country, or any one host, no matter how enthusiastic that host is in their self-hosting. It should be invisible as TCP/IP. And what we hope is in the future, this will just ship directly in your OS as just another system service. So where are things at today? Today, AutoMerge, you should use it today. It's very actively maintained. It's written in Rust. It runs everywhere and has bindings in JS, Swift, Go, and there's Python in Alpha. And KeyHive, available soon, TM. The code is open source. You can look at it. But it's security software, so like, let us do some audits first. Thank you.
Very much, both of you. We are a bit in a difficult situation with time. We have one question online.
Jonas asks, does AutoMerge keep the whole data set in RAM? If yes, how can I keep the RAM usage low for big data sets? And have you considered a database mode where bits of data are loaded into RAM on demand?
Yes, it does keep the data set in RAM. That columnar compression is pretty effective at it took a lot of work to actually be able to use the columnar compression at runtime as well as just on disk. But RAM usage has not, since that change, since we were able to do that, been too much of an issue. But we are also thinking about being able to partially load bits of a document. It's a bit further down the roadmap, unless it's important to you and you have enough money to sponsor us to do it. But we will get there eventually.
And to add on to that, a lot of people want to do things with multiple documents at once, and that we do load in just with your request.
Yep.
So another question? No question, perfect. Thank you very much. Thank you again, Brooke and Alex from AutoMerge.
Yes. Thank you. Good job. So